Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. I'm Justice Ann Gardner, and to my left is Justice Bob McCoy, and to my right is Justice Sue Walker, and we're your panel for the next and last two cases on the docket this morning. If the lawyers are ready, I'll ask the clerk to call the first case. Ms. Wilkerson?
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Denise Wilkerson here on behalf of the City of Arlington and Detective Allison Turner, an employee of the City of Arlington. First, I want to address the question of jurisdiction of this court to hear this interlocutory appeal. This was the thrust of the appellee's argument in his reply brief, and so I want to address it first. The trial court denied two motions in its order. First, there was a motion to dismiss employee filed by the city based on 101-106 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Second, a plea to the jurisdiction was filed on behalf of the City of Arlington and Detective Allison Turner. This interlocutory appeal is properly before this court because in 1999, the Texas Supreme Court held that a plea to the jurisdiction is the proper method for challenging a trial court's authority to hear subject matter jurisdiction against a municipality or its employees. Section 51014A8 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code specifically provides for an interlocutory appeal of a denial of a plea to the jurisdiction. Detective Turner, as an employee of the City of Arlington, is being sued in the course and scope of her employment. Therefore, this claim also falls under the Texas Tort Claims Act. Under 101-106E, Randall's claims against Arlington bar any suit against Detective Turner in her individual capacity. Detective Turner was entitled to dismissal of the claims against her upon the filing by the City of Arlington of the motion to dismiss, because this is an immunity statute. She is entitled to an interlocutory appeal. Randall's claim that a motion for summary judgment is the only procedural vehicle for an interlocutory appeal is incorrect when applied to a governmental entity and its employees. Now I would like to address the motion to dismiss employees. This was based on 101.106 of the Texas Civil and Practice and Remedies Code. This is a fairly new statute, but this court has addressed it in the past. Last year, in the opinion Texas Bay Cherry Hill versus the City of Fort Worth, this court held that a motion filed under 101.106 entitles the employee to dismissal from the lawsuit if the case is filed under the Texas Tort Claims Act. In that particular case, intentional torts were filed against the City of Fort Worth. This court held that even though they are intentional torts, which are excluded from the waiver of immunity provided by the Texas Tort Claims Act, that the employee is still entitled to dismissal from the lawsuit. The appellee argues that the second amended petition is the appropriate document for review on the motion to dismiss employees. Well, that is incorrect, because the statute provides that the employee is entitled to immediate dismissal, and also provides that it's an irrevocable election on the part of the plaintiff when they file their original petition. Courts have held, two courts of appeal have held, that you look to the original petition to determine the employee's entitlement to dismissal from the lawsuit. If you look at the original petition, he used the term negligence four times in describing the acts of Detective Allison Turner that allegedly led to his false arrest. So because it was filed as a negligence cause of action, the City of Arlington immediately filed the motion to dismiss the employee based on the Texas Tort Claims Act's election of remedies provision. Therefore, Detective Allison Turner is entitled to immediate dismissal from this lawsuit. Now I will go to the question regarding the plea to the jurisdiction.
Are there any other examples of where, do you know of in Texas jurisprudence, where you can't amend your pleading to change the posture of the suit, which is sort of what you're saying here? It's cast in stone based on your first pleading.
Well, it's not me that's saying it. It's courts of appeals who have interpreted the statute because the statute does say it's an irrevocable election. Those words are used in the statute. We look to what the legislative intent was. And Mission Consolidated versus ISD, a Texas Supreme Court case, explained the reason for the legislative intent. The legislature intended to reduce the delay and expense associated with allowing plaintiffs to plead alternatively that the governmental unit is liable because the employee acted within the scope of his authority. But if not, the employee acted independently, is individually liable. When you are suing a governmental entity, you're asking for the taxpayer dollar. So the rules are different. Now I will address the question of the denial of the city's plea to the jurisdiction. For the purposes of the plea to the jurisdiction, the court will look to the second amended petition, which was filed just a few days prior to the hearing, but the city waived any objection to the late filed motion. We went ahead on because we did not feel that the second amended petition changed the claims that were being made against the city. This case, again, is very similar to Texas Bay Cherry Hill versus the city of Fort Worth. In that case, several intentional torts were alleged against the city of Fort Worth by Texas Bay Cherry Hill. The plaintiff also sought a declaration that the city of Fort Worth had violated their constitutional rights. In this case, the immunity analysis is much simpler than the case that was presented in that case because there's no question about whether or not police protection is a governmental function. That's not an issue before this court. When you look to the second amended petition, paragraph 7 of the amended pleadings were ambiguous as to whether or not this was an action that was styled in negligence or intentional torts. When the plaintiff amended his petition, basically what he did is strike out all the words that were negligence and just stuck in Texas constitutional violation instead of the word negligence. But when you read the specific allegations, some of them in paragraph 7 are negligence actions and some of them are intentional tort actions. Either way, the city is immune from these cause of action. If Randall is alleging that Detective Turner negligently injured Randall by obtaining an arrest warrant, the negligent use of information is not within the waiver of sovereign immunity, and therefore the city was entitled to a plea to the jurisdiction. If Randall is alleging that Detective Turner intentionally violated his rights by seeking an arrest warrant, again, the city is entitled to immunity because intentional torts are specifically excluded from the Texas Tort Claims Act. The burden is on the plaintiff to show that a waiver of immunity exists. This is not the city's burden to show that we are entitled to immunity. It is the burden of the plaintiff. Randall's false arrest and false identification claims fall squarely within the intentional tort bar of the Texas Tort Claims Act. The specific allegations made by Randall that Turner investigated a crime, used a computer system, showed a suggestive lineup to a witness, and then obtained an arrest warrant, those are clearly acts of intentional conduct. Thus, all the intentional tort claims must be dismissed. The city also has no liability under the Declaratory Judgment Acts. Basically, what Randall is attempting to do is recast his intentional tort claim as a declaratory judgment action. This case is similar to the case of City of Eagle Pass versus Wheeler. It, too, was a false arrest case where the plaintiff sought declaratory relief. The San Antonio Court of Appeals held that the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction over a declaratory action that sought to have the plaintiff's arrest found to be an illegal arrest. In the Texas Education Agency versus Leeper, the Texas Supreme Court also distinguished between suits against governmental units seeking declaratory relief to clarify rights under an existing statute, or where the declaratory relief is no more than a recasting of the intentional tort claims where the plaintiff is seeking damages. In this case, the plaintiff is seeking damages. He may say that he took all the damage claims out of his petition, but they are still there. Paragraph 9, he is asking this court to overturn the Texas Supreme Court holding in the Bullion case, which said you cannot seek damages for violations of constitutional rights. He is also asking for damages reimbursement for the cost of his criminal attorney in the defense of the criminal charges against him. There's no authority under the Declaratory Judgment Act that he would be entitled to attorney's fees for the past criminal prosecution. The Declaratory Judgment Act only provides for attorney's fees in the pending cause of action.
He's also seeking future injunctive relief, isn't he?
Yes, and that is the next point, part that I will address. Injunctive relief is not available. To obtain an injunction, a party must prove a probable right to recovery. Plaintiff relies on the holding in the City of Elsa versus MAL. This case involved a declaration that the City of Elsa was violating the Texas Open Records Act by releasing records that contained personal medical information. So the plaintiffs were asking the court to determine, did these records contain personal medical information and whether or not that information could be released under the Texas Open Records Act. These are records that were in the possession of the City of Elsa. In this case, the plaintiff is asking to enjoin the city from saying that he was arrested for the offense that he was charged with. Well, that is a fact that it can't be erased by saying, you know, you just can't say. It has nothing to do with whether or not the records exist or not in violation of the Texas Open Records Act. City of Elsa also held that the plaintiffs in that case had not pled a case for injunctive relief, and they only allowed the plaintiff the opportunity to, it was remanded so the plaintiff would have the opportunity to amend his pleadings to properly plead a case for injunctive relief. Well, in this case, his pleadings for injunctive relief are asking that the city destroy the records of Harris County, Texas Department of Public Safety, Tarrant County DA's office. We have no authority. The City of Arlington has no legal authority over those other governmental entities to ask them to destroy their records. Additionally, the Code of Criminal Procedure provides a specific procedure for expunction of criminal records. It is not before this court whether or not he is legally entitled to an expunction under the Court of Criminal Procedure. It's just, we're just saying that there are other alternatives that the plaintiff could pursue other than suing the detective who arrested him in his individual capacity and the city who employed that detective. Additionally, since Randall does not currently live in Tarrant County, there is no factual support for the premise that Randall would again be subjected to the allegedly unconstitutional actions he states occurred previously, and therefore he has not pled sufficient entitlement to any injunctive relief. And he's amended his pleadings two times, that the facts are not going to change. This arrest took place in the past. Injunctive relief is to prevent future harms.
Is it your position that if we took everything that Mr. Randall said is true, other than expungement, there is no remedy for his purported wrongs?
Your Honor, if we take everything that he says is true, he also included the arrest warrant application that was filed by the detective and incorporated it into his pleadings. The arrest warrant application shows that she showed a lineup to the witness.
My question is it your position that he has no remedy for the wrongs done to him other than expungement, which would solve one problem?
Injunctive relief, he cannot enjoin. I would say under these facts and circumstances, even if everything he said was true, he cannot enjoin the city from saying that he was arrested for the crime of fraudulently obtaining prescription unless he pursues the legislatively set out remedy under the Code of Criminal Procedure.
Couldn't he ask that the records be sealed? Wouldn't that have injunctive effect?
The city of Arlington does not have legal authority to seal the records of Harris County, the Texas Department of Public Safety, or Tarrant County District Attorney's Office. All of those agencies would have the records of this arrest. He was not arrested by the city of Arlington. He was arrested by Harris County. The paperwork was transferred to the Tarrant County DA's office. The only record that the city would have the authority to seal if ordered by a court would be its own records.
Okay, I'm curious to know, there's a case handed down by the Supreme Court this past month called City of El Paso versus Heinrich, and deals with, among other things, declaratory and injunctive relief against a governmental employee and governmental entity, and I'm wondering, I'm curious to know if that case has any effect on your case, and you don't need to answer it now if you're not familiar with it, but if you could take a look at it and let us know, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Additional briefing time?
10 days? Okay. Is that all right? Could you give that to us in 10 days?
I have it with
me. Oh, you do? Okay.
Please, Court.
Mr. Brunner.
Thank you. When you really boil it down, there is but a fine line between democracy and dictatorship, and that line's drawn by our Constitution on whether or not government can be made responsible for its actions. And in our state, that is only achieved by equity or by declaratory relief. And the Supreme Court in Cobb versus Harrington, 1945 case, said quite frankly, the acts of officials which are not lawfully authorized are not acts of the state. And an action against the officials by one whose rights have been invaded or violated by such acts for the determination and protection of his rights is not a suit against the state within the rule of immunity of the state from suit. We cited also the Burnham versus Davis, similar case where the state claimed that DPS was immune by sovereign immunity, protected by sovereign immunity from declaratory relief, and that was an Austin Court of Appeals case, and they said no, as they did again in Moore versus DPS. So the lawsuit that Mr. Randall has brought is one for just that, declaratory and injunctive relief, to which he's entitled, and the Supreme Court's most recently, I have not seen the El Paso case, Your Honor, and I'll be glad to take a look at it and supply a reply brief if that's appropriate. But the city of Elsa is quite clear. In fact, it's not unlike this situation. These police officers filed suit. They asked for monetary damages. They sued for also for injunctive relief. The Court of Appeals upheld their right to do so. It's based on the question of whether the sue or be sued provision of the city charter was allowed them to sue. Supreme Court said no and took away their right or entitlement to monetary damages, but said that they were, it quite clearly said, just as we're saying here, the argument was the same. The city further asserts that the Court of Appeals should have dismissed the claims for injunctive relief rather than remanding those claims to the trial court. City argues the trial court lacks jurisdiction over the case because the plaintiffs sought injunctive relief against the city rather than against the officials alleged to have committed unauthorized acts. And then they go in and talk about the city of Beaumont versus Bullion, the case where they held that you have no right to recover monetary damages. And we've pled alternatively to ask that be overruled. But that's not a pleading for monetary damages within the Tort Claims Act, as counsel claims. It's a plea for allowing suits for monetary damages under the Constitution. But City of Beaumont versus Bullion clearly states, we stated that suits in this City of Elsa, suits for injunctive relief may be maintained against governmental entities to remedy violations of the Texas Constitution. And that's what we're asking for here. By the way, we've not sued any other entity other than the city of Arlington, because what we need out of the city of Arlington is a declaration that this arrest was unconstitutional. Alan Randall's completely innocent. The way in which he was brought into this case was a forged prescription was attempted to be filed at a pharmacy out in Arlington. The pharmacist became suspicious, called the police, and meanwhile the white male who was attempting to pass the forged prescription left. Actually, what the pharmacist did was call the doctor. The doctor said, no, that's not my prescription. The person left. The description of the person in no way fits the description of Alan Randall. There's almost a foot difference in their size. The guy was scuffy looking with a beard and so forth. What happens, as is what happened and we've seen in Dallas and here as well, is that they attempted to use a photo lineup to identify this man. The only way, the only connection, the only way they got an arrest warrant was to claim that he was linked to this prescription by the phone number. That link is contrary, clearly, to the right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures as defined in U.S. Franks versus Delaware. That is, they basically misrepresented to the magistrate the facts upon which they, quote, linked Alan Randall to this crime. The link was that some 5 years before, for about 4 months, he had the same phone number, which they then found there was no phone number on the script, but they took the name, which is obviously a phony name, and they then ran it in Google. Anybody can do this. You can put it in there and you pay $8 and you get a whole list of who had that phone number. And they found that this phone number had been assigned in a different to it. By the way, the phone number was never an Arlington exchange. It wouldn't have been in Arlington unless they had paid special toll to have it transferred over there. And it wrapped to another address, and they then said, but this same person who was named in the script, obviously a phony name, had that phone number 5 years earlier. And that was why they say they linked. Now, had they explained that to the magistrate, there would never have been a warrant issued. Had they explained that they run every other computer search on this man, he has no record, he has no bankruptcy, they did the whole thing. He has none of that stuff. And neither does anybody. They ran it on his parents, on his family. Nothing. And yet they went out and got a warrant based on the fact that they had linked him together, and they actually asked these two, the pharmacist and the pharmacist tech, without telling what the height of this person was. One of them did identify him, the other one did not. That's the substance of his claim for an illegal arrest. He cannot get this record expunged because under the Texas expungement statute, that stays on your record for the length of time that he's been no-billed by the grand jury, who looked at all of this and no-billed him after he spent a couple nights in jail, had to come up here, hire a lawyer, and get himself all the evidence that had happened. Of course, they sit on these things for months, so it was like maybe 9-10 months before that all this happened. He had to put it all together. And he was no-billed. Problem is, under that statute, a no-bill is not a determination of no probable cause. A true bill is a determination of probable cause, but a no-bill is not. Texas law is clear on that. And so, consequently, you have to have some determination. And as you've seen, we took the deposition of Detective Turner, who still claims he's guilty of this offense, and will state he cannot go and get this matter expunged unless he has a declaration that his rights were violated by the under the Texas Constitution. And with that, he's entitled to that. And the only relief he's asked for is under the Declaratory Judgment Act and equitable relief. The Supreme Court in Bullion and in the city of Elsa continually talks about equitable relief. And counsel mentioned that he asked for that part of that relief he's asking for is payment of the fees that he had to pay his criminal defense lawyer to represent him, and that's just part of equity. Equity can order reimbursement it's not damages. They're not asking for any type of mental anguish or pain and suffering, any of those sort of things, but you can ask for equitable reimbursement, just like the rescission of a contract. Any equitable relief you can get reimbursement for out-of-pocket expenses that you had incurred as a result of that relief. And that's the nature of that allegation. With regard to the pleading, first of all, I think it's a moot point. The Section 101.106 of the Texas Tort Claims Act addresses suits under this chapter. And it could, every one of those provisions says under this chapter. Now, the Supreme Court, counsel points out, has broadened that somewhat, although I don't think so. I think they rightfully said under this chapter means torts that were excluded by this chapter as well. And they've combined all that into what? Torts for money damages. Okay. If there was a claim for that, I don't want to get into why we had a negligence pleading on that, because it involved a case that then got turned around. But in any event, if that was, never been mentioned in the Tort Claims Act, but even if there was, those claims are gone. You don't get to wipe out the whole case. All along, there have been these claims for the violation of the Constitution. So, and that's exactly what the Supreme Court did in City of Elsa. In fact, even Mission ISD case that they talk about, the lady there pled for a number of intentional torts, interference with contract, et cetera. And then she also pled for damages and relief under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act. Supreme Court wiped out under 1106 her intentional tort claims, but they left her alternative pleading for her. And we know that this didn't, 101 of the Texas Tort Claims Act did not rescind the rules of pleading, nor the rules that an alternative pleading can be completely contrary one to the other, and you're still allowed to bring that kind of pleading. And then the courts upheld that. So there's no allegation in the amended pleading, there's no allegation of negligence whatsoever, just allegation of basically these constitutional right violations, which he's entitled to have under the court correctly points out. I mean, this is, the pleading is accepted as true. It has to be in this context. That he's had this violation of his constitutional rights. The court, Judge Sutterworth, correctly ruled that he had pled an action sufficient to get within the Constitution under both declaratory and injunctive relief. And there is reason for asking them to enjoin them from further claims that he is guilty of this offense, or to enjoin them from objecting to his attempt to get his record expunged once he has a declaration that there was no probable cause. With that, he can then go under Section 55 of the Texas Criminal Practice Code of Criminal Procedure and be entitled to that type of relief. And as a practical matter, now the Department of Public Safety has the right. They've not been brought into this case because it's not necessary if he has a determination that that there was no probable cause. But on these cases where people get no bill by the grand jury, the department routinely objects, and the Court of Criminal Appeals, as I've cited in the brief, has upheld those objections as being sufficient to deny an expungement because there's no finding of no probable cause. So the other point I would briefly point out, that this declaratory injunctive relief applies to any immunity, sovereign immunity being the state, governmental immunity being the municipality, but also to this qualified immunity they're claiming for Officer Turner. She is the officer that's entitled to, just as the court said in Cobb versus Harrington, to be held accountable for her actions, at least to the point of them being declared to be wrong and therefore enjoined. In addition to that, Officer Turner never filed. There's no jurisdiction of her appeal here because they appealed under 51.1014 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Section A5, which has to do with overruling for a governmental unit a plea of privilege. Officer Turner is not a governmental unit. In order for her to have an interlocutory appeal, and as the court knows, and I've cited the cases, there is a strict requirement that against interlocutory appeals, there has to be an overruling of a motion for summary judgment, which she never filed. And in fact, could not have heard of motion for summary judgment because just a few days after this deposition was returned and with less than the 21 days notice would be required in any event, and with none of the procedural requirements required by due process, for a motion for summary judgment, which, as the court knows, is a trial. It's a trial, and you're entitled to that due process. We didn't get any of that. The case was heard some 16 days after they amended their motion to dismiss, and, of course, there was no indication in that motion anywhere that it was a motion for summary judgment.
Counselor, I'm sure you've heard bad facts make bad law.
I've heard that, Judge.
If we
if we went with your argument in this case, it sounds like every time there's a no bill, or if there's a true bill and a not guilty found, we'll go right down this road.
Well, on the latter, no, because the statute's quite clear. Statute 55 of the Code of Criminal Procedure is that if you are found not guilty,